Hello and welcome to In Focus with Insight. My name is Pamela Hillig. I'm head of Insight Life Solutions, and this is an episode of the Open Books series in which we get to know fascinating and inspiring people in the actuarial and insurance community through the books that they have read and loved. Today, I'm so privileged to be joined by a very dear friend of mine, Soshin Subramani. Soshin is an actuary and lecturer at the University of Johannesburg. He's developed insurance and savings products in several countries across Africa and has run microinsurance ventures with international organizations, including the UN World Food Programme. In addition to training future actuaries or actuaries in the making, Soshin is a certified Time to Think facilitator, and he helps organizations create environments that ignite brave and courageous thinking. Soshin is chair of the boards of Aligned and Two Mountains Underwriters, and he's co-founder of Actuaries in the Making, or the AIM Virtual Vacation Work Program. Welcome, Soshin.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So, Soshin, tell me, are you a reader?
I am. I'm more so in my younger life. I found that I have been reading less lately, but definitely books have always been an escape into another world for me.
I think, yeah, that's what makes you read it. It's kind of ebbs and flows, but it's always there somewhere. And I'm very glad to hear that, because this isn't like a normal interview, in that we will still be speaking about your journey and your career, things that you're passionate about, but with the added angle of the books that have shaped you in some way. So I guess you can think of it as desert island discs for bibliophiles. But before we get into the books, tell me, what is keeping you busy these days?
Great. My main job is that I'm teaching actuarial science. So a huge part of my energy goes into my students and creating new courses and new opportunities for them. I've also just finished my master's in mathematics, so I'm going to entering into a PhD program now as soon as my proposal is ready. So I'm studying mathematics, which is keeping me busy. And then I continue to be interested in and playing around with independent thinking and how we can live our lives and be in such a way that we create as much of that in the world as possible. So my Time to Think work is keeping me busy, and I'm training to be a Time to Think coach. That's some of the things. And then obviously, Actuaries in the Making. The reason I'm here in Cape Town at the moment is to celebrate this amazing program that we created, which is certainly, I would regard, as a brainchild of yours. And that's about creating work opportunities for university students who are studying actuarial science during their vacation.
Lots to keep you busy with. And when you're not working or being an actuary or a lecturer or math student, what do you like to do in your spare time?
Lately, it's mainly been time with my family, my husband Niven and my son Caden.
Shout out to Niven and Caden.
Hey. Hey. So they just bring me so much joy. I think living life through a five-year-old's eyes has been such an incredible gift for me and Niven. And so we enjoy watching Sonic the Hedgehog at the moment and Peppa Pig and Garfield.
I'm sure he'll enjoy watching you on this podcast as well. You've touched on so many things I want to hear more about. Before we get into that, I'm interested in your reading habits. So we discussed the concept of being a reader earlier, but would you classify yourself as a reader with a capital R, and what does that mean to you?
Oh, what a nice question. I think I would. And I think to me it means like hearing thoughts of other people and actually entering worlds that other people have created. That's always been the fascination for me. So.
Who do you discuss books and reading with, if anyone?
Usually if I close a book and it's given me this amazing feeling of wow, I would go to Niven, my husband, first. and try to get his attention of how important this is for me. And I often bring it into my places of passion, like the people I work with at AIM. I'll often bring something I've read into the AIM meetings. And I guess friends who've become collaborators.
And what genres do you tend to read?
Okay, so definitely lots of sci-fi.
And
I love reading about sci-fi, about magic, about like alternate realities. I think that's my go-to place. And I think as I've become older and interested more in how people think and how our behavior impacts people, then I've started to read more about leadership and thinking.
Okay, I can sort of see how that's reflected in your selection today. So we asked you to choose 5 books to bring with. What's the first one we're going to talk about?
So the first one is got such a special place in my heart. It's called The Power of One by Bryce Courtenay, a South African-born Australian author. And yeah, I think of the 5 books, the order that we've arranged them in is actually the order that I've read them in my life. And this first one was such a powerful, like it evoked such powerful feelings for me as a teenager, that even though there's so much of the content of the book that I can't remember because I've never reread it, I still remember like things that how it made me feel about certain things in my life. Yeah.
It's so often when I'm talking about books, I think of the Maya Angelou quote that says, people won't remember what you said or what you did, but they'll remember how you made them feel. And I feel the same with books. I don't remember the details or the plot or the author, but I remember how it made me feel. Same with restaurants, but that's beside the point. tell me, what's the plot of this book? If you can somehow summarize it.
It's this crazy story about a young boy. It's from the time he's a toddler, I guess, until the time he's a teenager. And the span of his life happens just pre-World War II in South Africa. And it's a story about all this weird and wonderful friendships that he forms, lots of hardships that he endures, and essentially this journey of finding his own independent spirit through it all, and how this young kid who's got so little structure, so little support, ends up leading these tribes of people. So it's just this beautiful story of, I guess, overcoming hardship, discovering inner strength, and also impacting people because he was, in a way, raised by a weird village. Yeah.
Do you think there are any lessons in this book that have influenced your journey or how you react to things or perceive things?
I'm sure there are. And when I reread the plot and remembered certain things, I can see so many threads to things later on in my life. And so I can't help but wonder how much of it stemmed from some of the sparks or little flames that were created when I read this book.
Well, maybe one of the examples is, so I just read this plot summary last night because I haven't read the book, and it seems, you know, it goes through all kinds of transitions and from one state to another and changes. And one of the biggest transitions you've made in your life is going from very, you know, successful corporate career to an academic, you know, full-time academia. Can you tell us about that transition?
Oh, yeah. It's, I think, one of the things I'm really proud of in my life. And it was not an easy decision to make. I remember being filled with fear, actually. I think I've, at the time, spoke to you about it and other friends. And it was a mutual friend, Shivani Ranchard, who said to me that, you know, one of the things that has driven her was making decisions out of love and not fear. And I think that was one of the turning points that I remember in that decision.
So is it your love of education that drove you?
Yes. I, it was a need, I think, to see the world through different eyes. So I felt to a large extent that I was living in a bit of a bubble in the corporate world. And I've always had a passion for education. And so I think it kind of actually all fell into place. It wasn't as well thought out as I would like.
How life goes.
I think a huge part of it was actually just being in the right place at the right time. I was doing postgraduate studies. I saw a poster on the wall of the corridor outside the stats department that said UJ is now offering an actuarial science degree. And it was like all of these feelings that were connecting with me. And I said, oh, well, you need an actuary for that. And one of the things I was ready to do was actually to become a stay-at-home dad for a little while, because we knew that we were adopting a kid at the time. And so I was preparing for some kind of transition, and I didn't know what the transition would be. And so it all fell into place when I saw that poster and then spoke to the HOD, and then it happened.
meant to be. What would you say is the most surprising thing of this transition?
I think for me, it's how busy I would be. because I think I made the decision in part to move to a different pace. Although it has felt like a more easeful, more deliberate pace, even though academia is very busy. And I think also how much I've grown. You know, I think by just changing my context, it allowed me to open up such different conversations, you know, and conversations that I wouldn't have been having had I stuck to what was familiar and what was known and comfortable for me. So,
what do you miss about the corporate world? Apart from the money?
I miss the luxuries, you know, and the expansive thinking of solving problems in a very practical way. And yeah, like the strong sense of business acumen. You know, I've grown to really value all of these things we take for granted in the corporate world.
Yeah. What advice do you think you would give an actuary looking to make such a, you know, not necessarily the same move that you did, but, you know, really taking a leap of faith?
I would say the downside risk is not bad at all. And the upside, the potential to just expand, you know, horizons and open up conversations is so great and vast that it's just feels like it's so worth the exploration.
I guess the lack of, or the limited downside risk is because you can always go back to being an actuary, right? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I feel like my risk brain at the time convinced myself that actually if things don't work out, I always have my qualification to fall back on. I always have relationships to fall back on. And I think that gave me a certain amount of courage to explore.
Gosh, hope we don't set for revolution. Actuaries leaving en masse to pursue their dreams.
If there are any, come talk to me about coming to UJ.
Back to the power of one. Can you read us a favorite quote from this book?
So, again, reflecting on the plot and my journey, I feel like this is one of those little things that have somehow crept into my life along the way. And it's just a really simple message of a friend saying to the main character, PK, always listen to yourself. It is better to be wrong than simply to follow convention.
Love that.
Yeah, and I think in that part of the story, he goes, well, if you're wrong, then great, you learn something about yourself. But if you never venture to be wrong and to do that learning, then you're not really exploring what's inside of you. And I guess that's the theme of this, the power of one.
Tell me about this theme of, you know, being safe to make mistakes that I think you kind of subscribe to. Why do you think that's so important?
It's so important because I think it's a very hard thing to do. I've personally found it really hard. So when I'm talking to my students, I very easily say, just don't be afraid of getting the wrong answer. Just make the mistake. This is the way to learn actuarial science. And in a recent experience, for example, doing my mathematics studies, I realized that that's really hard advice to follow. It's so ingrained in us to be perfect and be precise. And I found myself telling myself that I don't know enough maths to continue. I don't know enough maths to solve this problem. And it was such a dichotomy for me to be saying this and feeling that it's so hard for me to live in my own studies. And so I really have newfound appreciation for the fact that learning to celebrate failure is not easy. It's a very hard thing to feel that something is going wrong and to replace that assumption that the failure is wrong with an assumption like me getting something wrong is exactly what I need to be doing to learn it. So, yeah, it's something like that.
And I feel like it's also something for managers and teachers and I guess people in positions of authority to learn and, you know, to take away the shame of making a mistake, because that can really, you know, impact someone's view of failure and their confidence to make mistakes.
Absolutely. And also the feeling that you're an outsider. So it was the thing that I realized for my students that I'm telling them just do this actuarial stuff, but they feel like they are outside of the actuarial profession and they're not meant to be here or they're not meant to be here yet. Like something has to happen for them to belong and to make those mistakes, which is exactly what is the feeling that I sit with. Even though now I'm going to be doing a PhD in mathematics, there's still a voice in my head saying, oh, but you don't really know this stuff. So how can you try? Yeah.
I want to get to the next book, but this is such a good time to talk about the research you're doing on failure and trauma within actuarial studies. Sorry if I butchered that, but can you tell us a bit about that work?
Yeah, it's a deep passion project of mine, again, based on all of this identifying with what students are feeling. It's occurred to me that maybe students are not feeling that connected to the environments that they're studying in. And my collaborator in this work, Shivani Ranchod, put it so nicely the other day. And I'll try to say it as eloquently as she did. She says, we take the top students out of the schooling system, put them through this rigorous training, fail students at an alarming rate, and somehow have convinced ourselves that this is all okay. Like this whole model is fine. And like that married with what I've been feeling for a while, that we're taking these bright, amazing people full of potential. And I get the sense that we're kind of dumbing it down and ironing away all of the creativity by saying things like, actually, there is only a right or wrong. Actually, you didn't round off to the right number of decimals. So, you know, so we create, I think, one of the flaws in actuarial education is that we create this obsession with perfection and precision at the expense of original thought, that what does the world actually need from us?
Gosh, that is so true. So what is the, you know, what's the research question you're looking at and any findings you can share with us so far?
So the question we want to ask is, what would it take to turn actuarial education into a place of healing and generating original thinking? And a kind of sub-question, I guess, is what would it take to create the safety and the places of growth for students to make them feel that this place and this system and this financial world that for many students has been historically oppressive to their people is actually a world that I can safely and successfully enter into. So right now, the evidence is very anecdotal. We're getting the initial reactions of, ooh, okay, I do remember some hardships and some difficult things. I can feel what the look left, look right conversation has done for me.
Triggered.
You know?
Yeah.
So far it's really, really gut feeling work. And we now want to systemize it and kind of formalize it by saying, okay, how can we robustly elicit ideas and experiences of both harm that's been caused as well as growth and healing that has occurred?
Gosh, and you're presenting at the ASSA convention in November on this.
Yes, we'll be presenting our first proposal for a framework in which to start to gather this kind of knowledge and wisdom.
Can't wait. Talking of students, nice segue. What's the next book we're going to talk about?
Ooh, okay. So the next book in my life, in chronological order, I guess, is Harry Potter. And again, I said to you that I love magic and any escape of world. And Harry Potter, for me, in my reading journey, was so well timed with me entering university. So The first movie came out in the year that I moved from Durban to Cape Town to study at UCT with these amazing magical buildings and beautiful mountain and people from all places, you know, and walks of life that I had never been exposed to. So it really felt like, for me, my university journey was entering this brand new world. And at some point when I caught up with all the books, then a book was getting released every July on my birthday. around my birthday, and a friend of mine would buy me that book for my birthday every year. So it was just like this wonderful journey that had, Harry Potter has such good memories for me because of that special feeling of a new book is coming out in July.
You weren't one of those who camped outside Exclusive Books in Cavendish. And why do I feel like you were?
I didn't. I never did, but it definitely crossed my mind a lot.
So is it specifically Philosopher's Stone that you, is that your favorite one? Or would you say the whole series is your favorite?
I distinctly remember The Half-Blood Prince, which I think is the sixth one in the series. I remember that having like a definite wow factor because of, like Snape's role in the whole story. But I would say the hook was the first one. And that's why, that's the feeling of, really entering this world that I've, like in the journey of my life, that was such a big moment for me.
Have you reread them?
No, I haven't. I tried starting to read to Caden because it's got no pictures. Okay. I don't get past
maybe in a few years. Do you reread books in general?
Not in general. I have read a few. I have reread a few titles. So Time to Think is one of the books that I've read over and over again, because I feel like as my journey with the thinking environment evolved, I get kind of new insights when I step back into that book. And then I have reread some fiction books. Yeah, like Q&A and The White Tiger.
Okay.
Recently, found myself rereading some of those. But in general, other than those, I can't think of many that I reread.
It would be an exception. Which Harry Potter character do you identify with the most, or is your favorite character? Could be different people.
Ooh, okay. So I identify with Dumbledore. I just love Dumbledore. And later on, when J.K. Rowling conveniently made him gay, I was like, oh, yeah.
Knew it all along.
And it was, And it was Jude Law playing him.
Oh, really? Yeah. I thought it was that old guy that played him.
No, in the later, I'm now referring to the later movies.
Okay. I didn't get that far in the movies.
Oh, you must. It's amazing. Okay. it's the new kind of, the last few movies have been around.
Oh, they Newt's look Commander, back. Okay.
And then her, Dumbledore, the young Dumbledore.
Okay.
Enters the story. Yeah.
And which house do you think you would be in?
I want to say, sometimes I do feel I would fit well in Slytherin.
But Slytherin isn't bad, like, by definition, right? It's just some, you know, bad characters were housed there.
Yeah, I feel, I think so. I mean, if I think about Snape, who turns out to be, like, such a hero of the story, and he was, like, all along, associated with Slytherin. Yeah, but I don't know. I think I secretly just want to be in Gryffindor.
How original.
Yeah.
Can you say Potter in a Draco Malfoy accent?
Potter. Sorry. Yeah, that's all I got.
Do you have a favorite quote from either the source of the Philosopher's Stone or any of the Harry Potter books that you can read for us?
Yeah, I think the one that I picked was at the end of the first one. So I think this is the one that I would pick. Also because it's funny, because Dumbledore always finds ways to give Gryffindor extra points. Somebody pointed that out to me the other day, and then I was like, yeah, it's, but the book is, the quote is actually when he's praising Harry. Sorry. So he's praising Harry at the end of the book, and he says, "There are all kinds of courage," said Dumbledore, smiling. "It takes a great deal of bravery to stand up to our enemies, but just as much to stand up to our friends." I was mistaken. He says this to Neville. Neville Longbottom. Yeah.
Gosh.
That's always stuck with me. But the courage to speak up.
Yeah. How does one give, and this is actually a conversation I was having today, how does one give feedback to someone you really like and respect, you know, a colleague or a friend, without making it personal? You know, how does one actually isolate the feedback to the issue rather than the person?
I think it's something that I find quite a hard thing to do. And one thing that I've recognized about myself is that the more I connect with my own feelings, the more courage I get to speak the truth about what I feel rather than to attack anybody else. And that for me has been a journey of growth. And I'm finding myself more and more trying to lean into that, like just be more connected with my feelings. And that is proving to be a source of courage and difficulty, you know, in terms of putting in the work to do that.
I like that. So one of the things you mentioned that, you know, you're passionate about or thinking about at the moment is connecting to your feelings and untraining your brain and your body in order to do so. So what does that mean?
Oh, you're actually linking all these topics so nicely, because this is very linked to the healing work that I spoke about and what I think needs to be done in actuarial education. So the thinking here is that As actuaries, and for myself as an analytical person, I think going into my head has always been a coping mechanism for me. So whenever, you know, if the world got hard, I leaned into my analytical and technical and logical prowess, and you know, like as a safe place. As a child, I'm sure I leaned into that to get praise and validation. As an adult, I probably leaned into it a bit more to maybe escape the hard feelings if any came up. And so I think, and again, it's a hypothesis, that maybe many people in our profession are used to leaning into their heads and not to their hearts. Funny enough, that's a very popular quote from The Power of One: first with the head, then with the heart. And I guess in a way, I'm now trying to reverse that and say, actually, even though it's harder, can I listen more to what I'm feeling? Because the feeling will lead to much more holistic and felt thinking, you know, which is a more embodied kind of sense of thinking, if that makes sense.
I want to get into, although, yeah, I guess it's a few books from now, but now this concept of thinking and what you mean by that. But before we do, what's the next book we're going to talk about?
So the next book is also a children's book.
Is it?
Yeah. He's actually one of my favorite authors and thinkers, Richard Dawkins, famous for books like The God Delusion, yes, and The Greatest Show on Earth. And this one I really loved. It's a children's book, and he explains like just beautiful concepts in the world, like what is a rainbow or where does the first person come from?
Oh,
like,
wow. You know,
and he explains it in such eloquent, simplistic language that I feel like it's the kind of beautiful simplicity that comes with a deep appreciation for reality, I guess.
And this book is called?
And it's called The Magic of Reality.
Okay. Have you shared this with Caden at all or not yet?
I have spoken to him about it, but this is a reminder, actually, of some of the questions. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, many of the questions he's been asking, like what is this and how does this work? I can start reading it to him. So it's an idea that you've planted.
Well, from your reading of it, what's the question that stood out to you the most? And you know, what was the answer? Do you remember?
I remember things like just the way, like how do we know how old things are? And I remember, for example, a simple thing like what is a rainbow? And how the way he explained this in this book is just very simple and beautiful and factual.
So this room, I mean, this kind of, I guess, touches on your work in mathematics, or your love of interest in mathematics. You're pursuing your PhD now. How has your relationship with learning evolved from, you know, I guess your UCT student days to now when you know, doing a PhD.
Yeah. A thought is just occurring to me that it's like I started speaking about magic and fictional books, and the next two books are going to be about nonfiction, and this is like called The Magic of Reality. It's like the nice segue into everything. So I think that's in a way so telling about the question that I've kind of learned to play more with my learning, as hard as that is, given my imposter syndrome about mathematics. It's been really hard to just play with it. And yet whenever I remind myself about why I'm choosing that field to study, then I start to connect more with the child in me who's just saying, actually, I want to play around with this magical world, because in many respects, a lot of the work that I'm doing is actually out of realm of reality, because in mathematics, you kind of like create the axioms in the world of the world that you want to live in. And then you say, what if these axioms were true? What does the world look like? And so there's so much play and freedom. And I guess I'm choosing things that are making me feel like I'm gifting myself with this playtime. Yeah.
Do you know, or can you explain in layman's terms what the research topic of your PhD is?
Yes, it is to understand graphs, which are basically just dots and lines connecting them. And so, like, think about a network, like who's connected to whom and things like that. And it's to understand the structure of what it means to be different types of graphs. So it's kind of, it's a field called category theory, which is like studying the structure of mathematics in a way. And so you can imagine like lots of dots representing different things in mathematics and lines connecting them. And I guess, yeah, studying that at a very abstract level, I'm still kind of figuring out exactly what about that structure I'd like to figure out. And yeah, that's kind of part of the play, I guess.
Amazing. Do you have a favorite quote from The Magic of Reality that you can share with us?
I do. And it's one from fairly early in the book where he is introducing this idea. So he says, "The magic of reality is neither supernatural nor a trick, but quite simply wonderful. Wonderful and real. Wonderful because real." Yeah. So I guess for me, that just is, it's such a reminder that the world, the real world, and everything we know and don't know about it is beautiful and wonderful if we can be connected to, yeah, its reality.
It's kind of a nice consolation, you know, if you read Harry Potter and you enter these magical fantasy worlds, and then there's always a bit of a come down that you're actually in the real world where this magic doesn't happen. But the real world is actually magical as well.
Yeah, it is such a beautiful reminder that, yeah, reality is magic. And
QED.
Exactly.
What's the next book we're going to talk about?
Okay, so the next book, as the next author, as you know, is one of my favorites. Her name is Nancy Klein, and she pioneered this work of the thinking environment. So she wrote a best-selling book in the 90s called Time to Think, and pretty much every decade since has kind of refreshed the work with the latest knowledge. And this book represents kind of her latest collection of ideas on this topic of how can we be with people in such a way that we ignite their best thinking. And so the title says it all. The Promise That Changes Everything, I Won't Interrupt You.
How did you come into the Nancy Klein universe?
It was through my actuarial career. So I was at Old Mutual, and I was exposed to a leadership program called Leading for Business Excellence by an amazing company, Liz DeVette Leadership Development Company, here in Cape Town. And I was on that course and noticed how amazing I was feeling and how the facilitators kind of knew how to speak to each of us in such a way that each person in the room felt like we were each growing on our own personal journeys. And the thinking environment was part of what we were learning in that course. And also the realization that they were in themselves trained in creating thinking environments, and that's how they could achieve that for us. And so I was due to move to London that year. And when I moved to London, I made it an explicit part of my personal development plan to study with Nancy, because she was living in Oxfordshire. She is living in Oxfordshire. And while I was there, got to do a few courses with her as part of my personal development journey, and just kind of never stopped studying it and experimenting with it.
If you could share, you know, one learning with a wide audience, what would it be from the thinking environment?
It's got to do with the quote that I've selected from this book. The learning is that we can treat people in a way that increases their intelligence. So for the world, we can behave with each other that increases our collective intelligence. And again, I guess it's in the title of the book, it's about that deep level of respect that we can listen not just to understand, but listen to change the brain in front of us. So we can listen to ignite thinking. And that kind of moves us from this world of just exchanging ideas to really giving permission, giving courage to explore kind of the amazing potential of each of our bodies and brains.
I'm sure you apply this all the time with your students. So can you give an example of how you've seen this in action?
One really interesting story, when I started teaching the first year, there were only 9 students in the third year class, and they all didn't know each other's names. So for me, it really struck me that they've been on this grueling journey together. They've made it to final year, and yet there isn't this connection or appreciation that we can kind of help each other think, right? And,
wow.
And grow.
Yeah.
And so I started at the beginning of each year taking my third years out for a day, just teaching them what relationships do for us and how when we are in relationship with each other, in supportive relationships with each other, that help us like give each other the kind of attention and respect that make us feel safe enough to thrive, what that does. And so, for example, now my students regularly appreciate each other, kind of like have exercises with each other. A really nice example is that at the start of each lecture, a team of students, a pair of them, is assigned to kind of draw up an agenda. So they send the agenda out to the class the day before, all items listed in the form of questions to ignite our thinking, and they design an opening question for the lecture as well. And they come up with the most crazy and beautiful and original questions for each other. Things that I would never have come up with on my own.
Like what?
Just the other day, they gave an Einstein quote that said something along the lines of, the only knowledge is experience, or the only source of knowledge is experience. And what is an experience in your life that has taught you something important? You know, so it's just like the beauty and depth of some of the questions they ask of each other. For me, it's mind-blowing and such a stark contrast to the environment that I first stepped into 5 years ago.
What is that quote from The Promise That Changes Everything that you'd like to read?
So Nancy writes in this really beautiful way. And so the quote I want to read is at the start of the book. And the title of the chapter is The Difference. I won't interrupt you, I promise. I won't interrupt your words or your thoughts. Imagine it. Imagine the relief, the possibilities, the dignity. You now have ground that is yours, unassailably. This is for you. Time to think, to feel, to figure out what you really want to say it, to consider it, to change it, to finish your sentences, to choose your own words, to become, because you can trust the promise, a bit bold, even eloquent, to become you.
Gosh.
Yeah. This is why Nancy Klein gives me goosebumps.
And I mean, knowing you, I know how you practice that in, you know, in so many settings. So so thank you for doing that. Thank you for creating that space with everyone you talk to.
Thank you. It means a lot. And it's also a hard thing to practice, actually, because in modern life, it's very difficult to connect with yourself and center yourself, you know, and remove distraction from our lives, and then to be with other people in a way that says to them, actually, nothing that's going to pop up on a screen or, you know, pop up somewhere else is going to be more important than you in this moment. Yeah.
But I also think there's maybe a discomfort in knowing that and kind of having that responsibility to finish your thoughts and own what you're saying and what you're thinking. I think at least, you know, for me, I often rely on, you know, validation from the person I'm speaking to and, you know, hoping that they'll kind of finish my thought and my sentences. So there's probably a bit of discomfort there as well.
Absolutely. And I think what underlies that discomfort is probably some kind of assumption that's limiting us, you know? Yeah, something like, am I worthy of being the one to generate fresh, new, original thinking here? Mm. You know, it's like something like, who am I to do that, right? Yeah, who am I to really explore where my mind and body will take me to next? I think something like that is probably sitting there. I don't know.
Thank you. Free counseling. We'll explore this later over dinner. What's the last book we're going to talk about?
So the last book is a recent book that I read. It was recommended to me by a friend and fellow Time to Think practitioner, Rosie Chirongoma. And the book is called What Happened to You. And it's written by Oprah, as well as a neuroscientist, come psychiatrist, Dr. Bruce Perry. So he's, I think that's a good way to describe him. He is a psychiatrist, but he also studies a lot of neuroscience. And sorry, I didn't read the full title. It's What Happened to You? Conversations on Trauma, Resilience, and Healing. Yeah. And the reason I chose this is it was just such an eye-opener for me that your circumstances impact the way you perceive your environment. So what happened to you dictates how your stress response system is activated by different things. So he tells us, like in this book, beautiful stories about, like, just powerful stories, like this one kid who was getting super, like, triggered in his maths class, and he was doing so well on his recovery journey, but came from in a very troubled home. And in spending a little bit of time with him and then observing him with his father, who he had a tricky relationship with, Bruce Perry recognized the smell of Old Spice, and he went back and recognized that actually the teacher, they were having such an amazing relationship, the teacher was wearing Old Spice perfume. And every time he would get that smell, the kid will be triggered. And it's such a simple example, but like part of the therapeutic journey there was for the teacher to change his perfume. And the relationship thrived. And just like, it's such an incredible, like, thing. And the book is full of these kind of stories.
What has this book meant to you?
So I became really interested in trauma ever since we adopted Caden. I was on quite a difficult journey, sometimes even getting consumed with, you know, not being able to see beyond the trauma and recognize the healing and celebration that needs to happen in our family unit, because my personality was like starting to obsess about, you know, all the things that could be going wrong. And I started reading about trauma and ways in which it can be, that we could be sensitive to it. And recognize that if we can start regulating our bodies before we relate to our feelings, before we reason things through, it's like he mentions these three R's, and he talks about like how the things that are stored in the lower parts of your brain, like your brain stem going up all the way, how your body first perceives things instinctively. and you can only access your higher order executive thinking, which he calls getting to the cortex, once you've regulated yourself through that journey. And so for me, it's been such a giver of permission on this journey that I've been speaking about of connecting to my feelings, and to recognize that actually it's okay if I can't think clearly about this, or if I'm struggling with that, because it's about my body receiving the sensory kind of responses that it's getting. And it's okay to feel it and move towards regulation. Yeah, regulating my body so that I can think clearly. Yeah. So I think it's, for me, it's been like this marrying of lots of neuroscience and things that I was feeling, and validation of it's okay to feel and interpret the world the way I do.
Who do you think should read this book? What kind of person would benefit from its teachings?
This is one of those books that I would say, I honestly would recommend to anybody who is thinking about why they react in certain ways to things, firstly. Secondly, I would say every parent, my hope would be that they figure this, you know, some of this stuff out, and just, you know, get connected with this kind of thinking that actually when a child is distressed and needs to be held, rocked, you know, when their bodies need to be regulated, that is the need before trying to correct. You know, it's like this idea of connect before correct.
Okay.
So that's how, I guess, how important I think that knowledge is for me.
Do you have a quote you can read from this book?
So this book is also so easy to read. It's so full of insights from a scientist who's been studying this, but it's also told in typical Oprah style. So it's this moving kind of story of my life, your life, and you know, it's told in a very nice way. So I think the quote I chose is actually from Oprah's section. Oprah's introduction. Not one baby in the earliest moments of awareness asks, "Do I matter?" Their world is a place of wonder. But with their very first breaths, these tiny human beings begin trying to make sense of their surroundings. Who will nurture and care for them? What will bring comfort? And for so many little ones, life begins to take its toll, with violent eruptions by the caregiver, or simply the lack of a soothing voice or a gentle touch. In our first encounters, our human experiences diverge.
What always strikes me, you know, the little I've read up about trauma is how important, you know, or how events at those very early days of one's life can actually traumatize you, you know, and that trauma can carry through to adulthood.
Yeah, that's been a fascinating thing for me to learn, that, you know, that kind of trauma gets stored in your limbic brain. Your body remembers certain things and really creates the way you will respond to different stresses. So I feel like it's such an important awareness and so helpful.
Yeah, just kind of knowing that it's there and recognizing that it is real is probably a good first step to kind of healing.
Yeah. I listened to something, I can't remember if it was something I listened to or read, but it was quite powerful when the person was describing post-traumatic stress as an adult. Like if something happens to you, part of the way you can deal with it is because you have the language for what happened before. So you have the language about what you feel before the traumatic event. And that is in itself so empowering. And yet, you know, when things happen, you know, pre-verbal trauma, before you have the words for it, that's when people start to think, oh, what's wrong with me? So this whole book is about moving from the question, what's wrong with me, to what happened to me.
Wow. So we've spoken through some amazing stories and ideas today contained in these five books. If I just summarize them or remind ourselves what they were, The Power of One by Bryce Courtenay, Harry Potter by J.K. Rowling, The Magic of Reality by Richard Dawkins, The Promise That Changes Everything, I Won't Interrupt You by Nancy Klein, and What Happened to You by Dr. Bruce Perry and Oprah Winfrey. So if I had to be very cruel and send you to a desert island with only one of these books, which one would it be?
Oh my gosh, I think it would have to be Harry Potter. I feel like I would need that magic of Hogwarts to assimilate into my new environment.
Yeah, I guess you don't really need to have conversations or time to think with people in that kind of setting. And tell us, what are you reading now?
I'm currently reading Interesting Times by Terry Pratchett.
Okay. Yeah,
it's, again, a book about magic, so I'm enjoying that.
Okay. You're a Terry Pratchett fan?
No, this is my first book of his that I'm reading.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I've recently been introduced through this podcast, actually, so we can chat about that a bit more.
Yeah.
And if people want to find you or follow your journey or stay in touch, where can they do that?
LinkedIn is probably the best place. Now that I'm working at a university, they can find me through the University of Johannesburg. And if anybody's interested in collaborating with the actuarial program at the University of Johannesburg, then it's definitely a place to find me.
Okay. So before I let you go, we're going to have an Oprah moment.
Ah.
So I'd like you to look under your seat.
Oh, wow.
And you can open the box.
Oh.
So this is a gift for you to say thank you for being on the podcast. And it's a book that I've loved that I thought you might enjoy as well.
Thank you so much. This means so much to me and I love it.
Oh, do you already have it?
No. I love the fact that it's this book because I haven't read it yet. But I know it was definitely on one of these lists of banned ones in many parts of the US. So it's always been something that's intrigued me.
So this is Mouse by Art Spiegelman. And, I guess for me, it ties into your kind of sense of wonder, your interest in trauma. The way people treat each other and what people can do to each other. So it's Art Spiegelman's retelling of his father's Holocaust story through cartoons or through comic, in a comic style, where each nationality is represented by a different animal. So I thought it might be a nice one for Caden at some point as well.
Oh, Pam, you're the best. This is amazing. Thank you.
Any last thoughts for our listeners?
It's just been such a lovely journey and, just going through this exercise of picking books and what they meant for me, even ones whose plots I couldn't remember. It's been such a nice walk down memory lane. So I guess just to say thank you for this experience. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Such a pleasure.
Bye. Bye.